Luck on Sunday, brought to you by Whirlpool. Bet with the world.
But time to introduce my first guest. Feel that his appearance on this show is long, long overdue after what has been a pretty stellar career. Let's enjoy some highlights.
The conditional jockey find of the season, of the decade, Aidan Coleman.
And Aidan Coleman will round off a great season with a success at Aintree. Jack Andersoy bridging the gap on the run to the line. Village Mick by ahead. Jack Andersoy draws alongside. And Jack Andersoy will win the Best Victor Gold Cup.
Paisley Park has moved on by two lengths with Aidan Coleman. He's won all his races this season. Now he's won the Sun Racing Stay at Hurdle.
Is still there, 50 yards to go. Snow Leopard S, Hill 16 on the wide outside. It's a race ahead.
It's number 13, Snow Leopard S.
The last, John Bonova, just in front from Captain Guinness in second. Now they're going to climb the hill. It's John Bon by a length and a half, by two lengths, by three lengths. John Bon, what a good horse this is.
What a good horse and what a good rider as well. Aidan Coleman, very, very good to see you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Nick. Yeah, it's a bit of a strange kind of time for me at the moment, but I'm here.
So let's cut to the chase. People have been wondering now since the 15th of June last year when you had a really horrific, life-changing fall at Worcester, wasn't it? Mm. What was going to be next? So you've now reconcile yourself to the decision, which probably won't surprise many people, but just tell us where you're at.
Obviously the prognosis early was very was quite bleak about, you know, returning to ride and all that, but kind of around September when I kind of the rehab was stepping up, I you know, typical rehab for any injury, like you really fly. And I kind of kidded myself thinking I could get back from this. And then it kind of got to around Christmas time. I had another operation around early December, I think, and since that, the progress has like really plateaued, and I can do the gym is very good because it's a stable environment. But as far as like walking on uneven surfaces or running, I can't run or jump or anything like that. Can't ride a horse really. Arguable. A lot of people would have said I couldn't do that anyway. But what's the difference? But so since Christmas, like any time I've gotten a horse since, it's not really gone well, and you just can't really do it, and I definitely couldn't do it wouldn't be able to ride in the race or anything like that. And speaking to Jerry Hill and my surgeon, the chances of that improving are negative now, and so that's it.
So reluctantly, had to say no more.
Yeah, on medical grounds. Yeah, my knee will never stand to the demands of being a jockey or anywhere near it. So that's it. Yeah.
I want to talk at some length about what's been an extraordinary career. But first, I want to take you back to the day that has changed everything, the 15th of June, 2023. You're never going to forget it.
No.
And I think because of where it sits in the year, the wider racing public perhaps were not acutely aware of just how bad your situation was. If you can you relive it for me?
Oh, I suppose I can, yeah. I can remember it anyway. It's Worcester, half eight. I don't particularly like summer jumping. Didn't really want to be there, really, within reason, but kind of had to. I took the summer off before and it didn't really go down very well, and I kind of felt I had to kind of show a bit more commitment, even though that was never the case. I had no real trainers to ride for the previous summer, so I just kind of thought, well, let's go and see a bit of the world, and I loved it, but, you know, it wasn't that well received, but, you know, that's fine. I've no, grievances, jockeys get hurt and that's that, but obviously I went to Worcester, and the horse I was riding, like, I was the only one who'd schooled him. He'd always schooled in front, and, you know, he'd never shown any inclination to do anything like that before, and he jumped the third last in front, he jumped the second last in front, and he decided he didn't want to jump the last, and so I hit the wing literally at 30 mile an hour directly with my knee. Not the wing, the wing probably would have been a little bit more forgiving, but those the lead-in rails are a lot more substantial and they're held in place by metal stakes, so might as well be hitting a wall. You know, the fact that it was plastic made minimum difference. And yeah, so it was pretty excruciating. But it was fine. The medical staff were good. I had oxygen within a couple of minutes. Didn't really touch the sides, but to be fair, I had the morphine in then straight away. And my leg was probably, I don't know what angle it was, that bad, and a lot of cuts and all that. So I didn't really, when I looked down,
but
I didn't
it was really, it was effectively at right angles,
kind of closer to that than where it should be. I didn't really know because I could see it was like looked really weird, and they'd cut my britches open, and my kneecap was kind of around here somewhere, and I could hear them kind of, they were quite urgent to straighten my leg with blood flow and all that. And once they did that, it was actually, the pain was pretty manageable. For a few hours, but then I was kind of left in a trolley at Worcester Hospital at like 9 o'clock for, I think, another 5 hours without pain relief. So it was pretty, that was a pretty dark time, and my phone had run out of battery. So I was just left on a corridor. I'd never forget it. And it was like the NHS, like, you know, they can only do so much. There was literally lines of us the whole way through, as far as I could see, up, down, and even in all the alcoves of just people trained to beds, getting sick, shouting, roaring, whatever, like, you know, with police. And I just kept asking for pain relief, but they were just too busy to kind of come to me. They found me a bed about 6-7 o'clock in the morning, still in my racing gear. And to be fair, I was speaking to Jerry Hill then.
So you were there lying in a corridor?
Yeah, no pain relief.
No pain relief for 5 hours, with your britches cut up to your knee, and you could see your kneecap.
They had straightened it. They had to straighten it very quick on the track
for blood supply.
But you could still see the. Oh no, it was still at a particular angle, and I think it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. Two nurses straightened it again with a doctor, but I had no pain relief for that. That was pretty. I had a bit of gas and air, but it didn't really touch the side. So it was, And I said,
5 or 6 hours, when, as you say, no phone, no contact, no people, just that noise around you, people in distress. What were you thinking about life, your career, beyond just the excruciating pain?
If there was a fellow with a chainsaw or a substantial saw, I would have given him any money, just cut it off at that stage. It's mad. But the whole way through, the whole rehab from the start to the finish, I did it all by myself as well, really, with Emma Edwards and Conor Schumacher, who's always one-on-one. Kind of, you just live in the moment and you just get it done. And, you know, you have to be pragmatic about these things. You know, I had a broken leg or whatever it was. You just deal with it, you know, and then you kind of worry about the next hour and the next hour and the next hour. And, you know, it is what it is, isn't it? Jockeys get hurt and that's just that, you know.
And clearly, no one is going to diminish what has happened to you and the effect it's taken and the toll it's taken on your life. But you and I were speaking yesterday and you said to me, look, I don't want to come on and play the victim. It's a week where, you know, we've seen a jockey get killed. We know the predicament somebody like Graham Lee is in, who would have been a good friend of yours.
Yeah, I rode with Graham for a long time, yeah.
Yeah, that for you must provoke quite a mixture of emotions, that you're able to sit here today and say, I'm done, even though medically you've been retired.
Yeah, like I've still got a normalish life ahead of me. And my, you know, although I can't ride in the race and I can't do a lot of things, I can do most things, if you know what I mean. And you have, like I say, you have to be realistic about these things. I don't have a lot to complain about in my career. I was pretty fortunate with injuries, a few broken bones here and there, but no, I think 3 months was my longest time off before this.
Now, for those of you who are enjoying your breakfast, you may wish to look away now. This is sort of where we... Now, that's all right, isn't it? This is presumably... A bit down the road, is it?
No, that was the day before the operation. I was in hospital for about 2 weeks. They couldn't operate early on. That's after the operation sometime. And
this actually shows you exactly what's happened.
If you look at the top left where the majority of the screws are, that's the top of the tibial plateau, and that was pretty much like sawdust. So you had to pull it out and kind of rebuild it with a composite and put it back in. So it's effectively a modern-day bone graft or something like that. But the problem with that is I lost a lot of the cartilage between the tibia and the femur, and that's effectively what stopped me from coming back. All the other injuries, you know, they'll never be the same and they'll heal to a point, but it was all the damage done inside the joint is what's stopping me.
Now, it won't have been lost on many people. It certainly wasn't lost on me, what you said there about not really wanting to be summer jumping at 8:30 at Worcester, but you kind of felt you had a bit of an obligation to do it because you hadn't done it the previous year.
Yeah, I don't want to be. I don't want to be bitter or anything like that about it. You know, it's just you have to. You have to do it. And you know, modern day jockeys. You know, you go on about, you know, the Sunday evening racing. You know, the fat lads at the moment. And you know, we're all kind of self-employed. So people always say like you don't have to ride, but it's not. You do have to ride. You know, if you're offered rides or, you know, you do have to be on call and you have to do it, and that's simple as that. I know technically obviously we don't, but you know, if you're a professional sportsman you need to be out there.
Do you think there's a bit of you, however senior you get, you never earn the right to dictate what you're going to do because people otherwise think you're being a bit half-hearted or you're playing at it?
Yeah, basically, yeah. And I, like, to be fair, I'd known really to ride for that summer. You know, if I rode for those couple of months I took off, I probably would have had about 20 or 30 rides and a handful of winners. So financially, it wouldn't have been much anyway. But yeah, it's just one of them things. But you know, it happens. You know, like if you know, you say if I kept riding on, or if I had the opportunity to keep riding on, there could have been a worse injury down the road. Mm. You know, jockeys get hurt as we well know, and some. You know, and more serious than that, and so you have to be realistic about these things. That's, you know, what's for you won't pass you, and this is my lot, and this is what I've been given, and I just have to make the best of it now.
But the fact that you had the sort of presence of mind the previous year to say, right, I actually want to take a little space out, do that for myself. In any other walk of life, people would think that was quite a sensible thing to do. People take sabbaticals all the time. If you're a professional jockey, maybe if you're a professional sportsman in any other walk of life, but if you're in the relentless drive of being a professional jumps jockey, as you were, why do you think people would consider that to be a strange thing to do?
I don't know really. I don't know if I knew beforehand like what would happen, I wouldn't have gone. You know, I would have just kind of kept my head down and had those few rides and done it. But like, it really made no difference to what I did. Like I said, I missed a few rides around the summer tracks. No disrespect for them. Mm. We know why they race in the summer. They're most of them are too wet to race in the winter. It's no, I don't know really, to be honest. And that's why last year I kind of thought, you know, at the Perth, the one the week before, I was at Worcester for one that day, and I think I missed the winner at Aintree the next evening. I think I had one or two rides up there. So, you know, I was pretty committed to, you know, kind of showing that I was willing. It was just, I never really had the opportunity last winter, after I took the couple of months off. You know, my rides were well down, and what I was riding was, you know, they were all in the first four. And I think a third of my winners, that's my last season riding, were all in big race winners on the Racing Post. You know, I'd winners at Punchestown, Aintree, you know, I finished at Sandown, winners at Listowel, had a lot of rides in Ireland.
Yeah.
So the rides, the good rides were kind of there, yeah. And I was really, you know, doing well, and I think I was riding better than ever, but I didn't feel like I was getting enough, so I kind of wanted to commit to it again a bit more and get my numbers up as well, because I had, you know, quite good numbers for a long time. But after kind of, you know, I didn't really have any desire to be champion jockey, you know, after I had the taste of those big race winners. So I and I had a lot of good horses to ride, so I kind of tried to focus on them, but it didn't really work. But, you know, as I said, I've nothing to complain about, really. You know, I've really enjoyed everything I've done, and I'm very sad it's over, but it is what it is.
I was just watching that little bit of tape back at the beginning of the show, and I, God knows how long ago it was. When did I describe you as the conditional find of the decade?
2007 or 2008.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And at that time, how did you think things were going to pan out? What in your mind was the future going to look like?
I don't know, but
you were the next big thing.
Yeah, I was champion conditional. I think it was champion conditional the next year. I rode in the national that year, and I rode in the national every year since, bar the COVID year. I think I was like a 7-pound claimer. And I got round, and then the next like 7 years I fell or unseated or something, or got brought down. So it's
chose the wrong one.
But that was the next year, that was Monmouth, yeah. And I picked Stan, who was in that clip actually. But I'd love to go back, because like, I don't think I would have been very easy to deal with then, because it all happened quite quick for me. And I think Venetia put up an awful lot. And I rang Venetia last night to kind of say thanks for everything, because I think we were over 300 winners for her.
You were a real team, weren't you, for a
great
good
team,
long
but
time.
I think I should have been easier to work with, probably, because when it kind of happens that quick, you know, the the winners are supposed to win and the losers are disasters. And, it, you know, it took a few years to realise that, you know, just I really mellowed out and kind of took it all in my stride the last probably 7 or 8 years, and I think it would have been a lot easier to deal with.
OK, so why were you difficult to deal with in the Venetian?
Oh, no, I think it's just younger. When you're younger, you just kind of want everything to happen, and if it doesn't happen, it's a disaster. You never really see past the, you know, the present day and kind of reflect on, you know, horses get beat, it's fine. You know, you've got 6 rides tomorrow, you know, a couple of them will probably win, and just get on with it. And this took me a while to figure that out. But Venetia was great with me, and, you know, I said we had some wonderful winners together, and... she's a brilliant boss.
So how did you end up in Venetia in the first place?
So I was very lucky. I went to Henrietta Knights, and I got great tutorial there from herself and Terry. Terry was great help to me, massive help. They both of them kind of played off each other. Terry was more help on advice on, you know, jockeys and all that, and Hen was a lot better at... a lot more involved in kind of the schooling and kind of, you know, making me a better rider. And, you know, there wasn't a yard probably for a conditional to get going. So they suggested Venetia's, and Venetia gave me the job, and my first winner in the following October, and as I rode in the National in April. To be fair, one thing I'm proud of is I pretty much rode winners every month for the last, I don't know, 17 years. You know, I never really had many dry spells, and so I'm proud of that, because it meant I did my job well for a long period of time. And it's arguable whether we left some behind, and I definitely made the wrong decisions on a few things. Like before my first Grade One winner, I'd given up the ride on Cue Card, Thistle Crack, National winner, and a few more. So
The National winner, I suppose, will haunt you a little bit, that you didn't ride Mon Mom. But was that a fairly straightforward choice at the time?
Well, they were both kind of 100-1,
so it was a bit of a coin toss.
Yeah, it was a bit of a coin toss. And I rode Mon Mom in the previous year's Grand National.
He was like a short price, wasn't he?
Shortish price. And then I rode him in the next year's National, and he was a shorter price again, and I literally decked him. It was probably the only time he ever fell at the fourth last, when he would have actually been placed again. But, you know, I kind of laid that to bed, you know, after what happened to Liam, because, you know, he deserved that, really. And, you know, it's he won the National and I didn't. And, you know, there's bigger things in life, as we've seen, as you're going to talk about later on in the show. And the only thing about a National is the one race that probably transcends the sport. Well, it did those days anyway, when it was proper fences and 40 runners, but it's probably losing a little bit of its allure now. But that's another kind of conversation, isn't it?
Well, it's a conversation that you brought up, so let's have it. You've ridden in the race an awful lot. You rode in the race before the changes to the fences in 2013, and indeed, you know, Mon Mom, you rode in 2008 and 2010. How much has it changed for you?
It's hard to kind of... I was thinking about this the other day, and probably when you get older, probably, and you ride in so much, your experience probably... kind of helped you deal with the occasion, and you kind of, you know, you're just more experienced, aren't you? You know, when I first started riding, I was like literally claiming and very new to the sport, I've been a jockey anyway. And I understand the changes have to be made. Racing needs to come into more modern day, you know, society and make changes. I do understand all of that. But it's kind of at the National's expense. And I don't think that's anyone's fault. I think, as you say, changes had to be made, and you have to be seen to be doing stuff. But I think in doing so, unfortunately, and it probably can't be helped, it does probably take the... it definitely takes the achievement of getting round out of the race as more than what it used to. That's only my experience, you know, from riding in it and that. And the only thing I didn't really like is changing the number of runners. I think that's detrimental to the kind of the whole, the attachment to the race for people who want to tune in for one race a year. I think the fact is 34 now instead of 40 is, I think it's not great. But I do understand changes have to be made, and that's just that, you know. It's modern day society, isn't it?
Gabby Whitfield is coming in later, who's the head of welfare communications for the BHA, who've just launched their horsepower campaign, and it's very timely with the Grand National this week as well. Mm-hmm. But
Yeah, and that's a great initiative as well, really, isn't it? Because, you know, you can... It's like Googling your symptoms and you're sick, isn't it? You always come to the worst-case scenario, so it's great that there's a website there that's very transparent with all the statistics, good and bad, but it's always important to put them into context, because you can phrase these things how you like. It's like with the whip rules and all that. If you asked every member of public in the street in London there, do you think horses should be hit with whips? They'd all say no. But if you actually put into the context of what the pro cushion actually is and educated people on it, you'd probably get very different answers, wouldn't you? It's all about how you phrase stuff and how you put stuff out. It's education, isn't it, basically? And, you know, we have a really high standard of welfare for horses, and there's a lot to be proud of in the sport. So, you know, we probably should own it a bit more rather than bowing down to people who will never be happy until horse racing is gone, really.
And I suspect, without wishing to put words in her mouth, that's kind of what Gabby will say when she joins a little bit later. Let's talk a little bit about you and Venetia and why in 2023, when you had your last ride, you weren't still the stable jockey to Venetia Williams, given how well you'd got on in that early part of your career and given how many winners you rode for her.
Yeah, I had a great journey. As you say, I rode winners for 110 different trainers, and a lot of them from claiming straight through to the end, which was, you know, again, something to be proud of when I'm looking back, reflecting on, you know, what the last 17 or 18 or whatever years has entailed. And I went from Venetia's to got offered a job with John Ferguson, which was in real life, really. When I, you know, look back now, it was kind of, I had a 2-year contract, and I think it only lasted about six months.
So was that a straight leave one for the other?
Yes, yeah.
It was, yeah. Like, this is too good an opportunity to turn down. He's going to be the next big thing.
Yeah.
In fact, he was for about 5 minutes.
And it was looking like it was only going to improve. And I still rode a lot for Venetia in the following years, but obviously, you know, when you separate from a trainer, that's probably the wrong word, but when you kind of move on.
Was she good? Was she fine about it?
Yeah, she was brilliant. She was, you know, looking back now, she was brilliant about most things, to be fair. And
Do you think other trainers wouldn't have been as fine about it?
I think it's like anything. When you leave a position, you know, and even when, you know, jockeys, and I've gone my separate ways from trainers, it's always the same interviews, like, we wish them luck, and, you know, they're still going to be part of the team. It never works out.
None of us believe it, you know.
No, I know, yeah. But it's just regurgitated from, it's just a template kind of.
We still got on great, we're still the greatest of mates.
Yeah, yeah,
you exactly. You know they hate each other.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I can safely say there's not many, I have very good relationships with all the trainers I rode for, past and present.
Yeah.
But it is, when you move on, but they have other jockeys coming in to ride out, and it's a competitive sport, so they can't look after you when you've effectively left, or whether they've kind of marginalised you anyway.
And that Ferguson flame, it burned pretty bright for a few months,
yeah,
didn't it?
Yeah, I think I had 60 winners, or 59, from April to December.
That's insane.
Yeah, it was really.
So this
good.
Was when you were going to be, this is, right, he's going to be champion jockey now.
Yeah, I think it was second to Richard Johnson that year.
Yeah.
And it was Dickie's first championship as well, so. Yeah, it was a great year, and then kind of went from there to John Joe's when I was there for a year, or 2 years maybe, John, over 100 winners for John Joe as well. He had a very bad bunch. No, it's not very wrong, but he didn't have a great bunch of horses at the time. But we had a lot of winners. He looks like the quality's gone up again, which is great for them. And be good friends with John Joe Jr., so that's fine. But when I was, he didn't have the best bunch of horses, and John Joe Jr. was coming through. And
I'm getting the feeling it was a very moderate bunch of horses. I'm getting that strong vibe.
Yeah, sorry for repeating myself. But you can't
pull back from it now.
No. I think it was well documented at the time. It was no one's fault. You know, yards go through that. But, you know, because of that, you know, those horses needed claiming off, and John Joe Jr. being a 7-pound claimer and a son, and like as good a condition has come through in the last whatever years, probably since me. he was going to ride him, so I just thought there was no falling out. I literally just stopped going in there, and that was that. And I was freelance for, I don't know, but I also had the support of good trainers, like really good trainers, like Anthony Honeyball, Emma, Charlie Longson. Probably shouldn't have started naming names because I forgot anyone now. And I rode a lot of winners in those times. And then, and through John Joe, obviously, had the link with JP. And they were fantastic, JP and his family and Frank and his team and all that were fantastic for me for the last, you know, 7 or 8 years. Nearly got to 100 winners for him, and some really big winners in there as well, which was very important. And, you know, I can only be grateful for those opportunities. And,
was that the constant trade-off through your career, trying to marry up the quality with the quantity? I got the sense, say a decade ago maybe less, that you were getting a little frustrated that the winners were flowing,
yeah,
but the big ones weren't coming.
Yeah, like there was big handicaps, you know, I won Welsh Nationals with Venetia, yeah, and Taquin de Sol winning the Paddy Power, whatever it's called now, sort of 15 different names since that.
And but you were on the big stage all the time.
All the time. But
you just weren't getting the main part.
Yeah, and as I say, I gave up a couple of opportunities in Kilkerrin and Thistlecrack.
How did that happen?
Well, I got the ride in Kilkerrin at Punchestown, and I committed to him for the next year. And literally about a week later, I got the John Ferguson job. So I had to ring Colin Tizzard up and say, this is the situation, and rightly so. They wanted more, you know, they wanted a committed jockey, which ended up being Paddy, and I think he won the King George next year, and he won the Charlie Hall and whatever else he won.
Was Colin fairly cut and dry?
Oh, no, Colin's brilliant. You know, yeah. I rode a lot of good winners. They let me ride Native River, won an Old Roan Chase for them as well, and plenty of winners for Colin, and they're again one of those, you know, trainers that, you know, that I used to ride a lot for over the years without being committed to them, yeah, and vice versa. So no, he was very good about it. But I think I'd nearly 1,000 winners before I had my first Grade One, which is Paisley.
Unusual, isn't it?
Very, and it was kind of nearly embarrassing at the time because, you know, you kind of should, when you see lads, you know, having them 17, 18, you're thinking like, geez, I wait till I was 28 or 9.
So when the microphones come under your nose, when the horse is finished and you've won your Grade One and they go, oh, Aidan Coleman, it's your first Grade One, was there a bit of you thinking,
I suppose it was a lot of relief at the time as well, but luckily they came a lot more plentiful after that, to be fair, but I suppose when I waited that long for that initial Grade One, one thing I did is I always appreciated those good horses more, those big days more, and I literally can remember putting my colours on to weighing in of every Grade One winner I rode. It was only about 13 of them, but, you know, I really enjoyed, you know, them ones, and I understood how privileged I was to be in that situation, and it wasn't lost to me because I waited that long for them.
And when Paisley Park had his sort of renaissance, really, this season, I suppose, or just, you know, carried on doing amazingly well, even though he wasn't winning, you actually, even though it was looking a bit grim for the knee at the time and you were wondering whether you were going to come back or not, you rolled up to Newbury to see him, didn't you?
Yeah, it was the first time I've been racing, and I think I haven't been since, and I've been since the fall, and I've only been a handful of times, mainly Cheltenham to do box talks, which is it was a bit frustrating, but, you know, you have to make money somehow.
Got to keep putting them.
It is as simple as that, really, yeah. But Andrew Gemmell was always, he always checked in when I was injured, and he invited me to Newbury, I took him up on the offer, and it was, I think it was, he beaten a short head 3 times, which was very frustrating for Tom and all that, but he gave him wonderful rides. Sometimes they just don't win, and his age was catching up with him, although he wanted to be there and he was still running to a high level, he was just lacking that kind of late on gear that he always kind of found with me. And yeah, it was a shame he couldn't win this year because I really did want him to win.
Was there a bit of you that was just thinking, God, I just wish I could get on him? And
oh, obviously I wanted to get on every horse at the time.
Did you feel that you might be able to do something because you knew him so well?
No, and I'm not just saying it to be political or that, you know, I say the right thing, and Tom Bellamy's a good friend of mine, but he gave him, like, his Ascot ride was as good a ride as Paisley Park's ever got. It just didn't win. He literally did nothing wrong, and he did the other 2 times as well. And I'm not just saying that, it's easy to say it, but if you dissected them races, I know him better, but Tom rode him how I would have rode him all those times, yeah, as well. So,
should we have a look at him winning the Stayers Hurdle?
Yeah, 2019.
Let's do it in 2019. This, of course, was part of Golden Hour at Cheltenham, that wonderful afternoon, that Thursday afternoon. And he, I mean, how much did he have left this day? No respect for the last.
No, I think I had no respect for the last. He'd never made a mistake before that, I think. So.
Look at the ears.
Yeah, they've become famous in the end, didn't they? Great day.
Very special horse, very charismatic horse. How much pleasure did you get from the joy that Andrew, Emma and Barry clearly got out of this animal?
And my, you know, it was a journey for all of us, if you know what I mean. And every time we get up, Emma and I would say, like, aren't we so lucky to be here and have him? And that was from kind of probably that day the whole way through, every time, even the Cup of the Year where he kind of got beat a few times. He was never lost on us, the significance of him. And there was a journey with that horse nearly, and, you know, like he's nearly probably qualified to come here and sit on the couch and talk to you. He's that clever, you know. So, yeah, he was a special horse to be associated with, and I always appreciated him.
And I know, having spoken to you about John Bon many times, that you're fiery and passionate about him, aren't you?
Yeah, probably. Look, you know, it's kind of in the past now, that, unfortunately, so I've probably lost...
The thing is, though, I could see a bit of you with Paisley Park all the time you weren't riding him.
Yeah, John Bon was, you know, I think he was a victim of his price tag, really, and, you know, and people, because he's a bit precocious, which is a trait of most walk in the parks, which is fine. They usually, you know, when he was going, he was such a straightforward ride, but he was just kind of made out to be something he was not, which, you know, kind of frustrated me. But looking back now, you know, I should have just said nothing and just rode him, because it probably made me look better than I was. Again, I think it's more a victim of his price tag, really. People just started knocking him because he'd jig-jog and he'd walk. He gets sweaty, but, you know, the Montjoux line is like that. It doesn't stop him running.
Well, I mean, his record speaks for itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, he's fantastic.
And he's still a young horse.
Yeah, no, he's got more years ahead of him, and he's got so many options trip-wise and all that, even though I think he wants good ground, and 2 miles and aggressive ride is probably his forte, but he's such a straightforward horse, you can do whatever you want in him, really, to be honest.
And in terms of the sort of feel that jockeys dream about from a horse, is that the best one you've had from him?
Aintree, I think, the previous run. He won at Aintree like 2 weeks before and put it like a really fast time and all that. And then he came back. He obviously improved at racing that year because he fell in this
Warwick,
yeah. And he was only a novice as well, taking on, you know, Captain Ginister is a champion chase winner and a few more good horses. So he's a very, very good horse, and, you know, and I was lucky to be associated with him for a time.
Now, when this journey as a jockey began, had you given much thought to what else you might have been doing at the same time?
No, and like it's scary. Like I was in the gym last week, and I've told a few people that what was gonna happen today, and it was kind of a bit emotional because it was kind of my last week as a jockey, and it's all I've ever kind of wanted for a long time, and it's kind of onto the next chapter now, and I have no idea what that is. I've never thought about it. Committed everything I had to being a jockey, and then I committed everything I had to the rehab, and now it's just a bit like, wow, there's a big bad world out there, and you know, I need a job. I need something to do. I need something to focus on, and scary time in my life, but it'll be fine.
When you were a child growing up, and thinking about being a jockey and riding, what were the things about it that really interested you, really stimulated you?
I suppose it's just the winning, isn't it? It's just being competitive. I'm very competitive with everything I do. It's just something some people have and some people don't, and it's not necessarily a good thing, but it does help to the profession, and it's all I ever wanted to do from as far as I can remember. And but then, you know, I have to be appreciated that I did it for a long time and did well at it, so I'm very proud of that, but I would have liked a few more years. I would have liked to got to 40 and kind of been able to put a bit of thought into what the next step was. But although it's kind of been a bit doom and gloom with this, you know, I never really accepted that it could be the end. And so I've never thought about what's next. And, you know, I want to stay in the industry. I want to help out. Or I want to do something. And I've no idea what that is. So any ideas would be greatly appreciated.
And I suppose the reason I asked that about what it was when you were very young that got you interested in it was sort of then trying to work out, right, well, what do you need? What do you need in order to give you that or try to replicate that feeling that you got from the cut and thrust of riding and that competitive?
I think once I find something to do, I don't think retirement would be that much, you know, so you see some ex-jockeys that really struggle with it. I don't envision that. I could be wrong on this now, I don't know, this is all new territory for me, and I don't envisage that being this huge hole in my life. Mm-hmm. Once I find something to focus on and commit to that 100%, or if it's a few different things, you know, bring it on, you know. I want to kind of, as I say, stay in the industry and really commit to something, and I think once I have that and my mind is busy, you know, I'm not an adrenaline junkie as such, you know,
I'm not retiring. You don't need to feel fear to exist.
No, not really. And well, the thing is, you have to be realistic. I'm not able. You know, I'm not retiring just because I'm old or, you know, just don't want to do it anymore. I'm retiring because I can't do it. So, you have to accept that. And, you know, it's all well and good looking at Aintree next week, thinking, oh, I should be there, but if I was there, I wouldn't be able to do it. So, you know, that probably makes it a little bit easier that I've been, you know, kind of forced to retire on medical grounds. So I just want something to do now. You know, there's only so much I can focus on rehab and all that. So, yeah, whatever the next chapter. It's a bit scary. Some people could say it's exciting, but I kind of would like a little bit more structure and a bit more of a plan. But, you know, I paid for all my rehab all myself, and I've, you know, I'm fortunate I did well out of the game, but I need to work, and I need to make a living, definitely.
Now, people will be quite surprised by that, I would think, that you've had to basically finance your recovery when we see, you know, so much work going on behind the scenes. We hear so much about Oaksey House, Jack Berry House, the work of the Injured Jockeys Fund, people getting back on track, and yet this recovery has come at a significant personal financial cost to you.
Yeah, like
it. So look, just it is, explain how that works.
I'd prefer like it's probably something I don't really want to get into too much. But for me to have the best chance of coming back, or even at the start, because it was very prognosis was very bleak. I just wanted to have the most normal life as possible, and for that to happen, I needed a lot of physio, a lot of everything, and it wasn't really available. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if it cost me, you know, well over 10 grand, I think, or whatever, my rehab, that's a small price to pay of, you know, having a relatively good working leg. And, like, that's one thing with Emma and Connor, like, they were literally on call 24/7.
This is your physio.
Physio Emma Edwards, you know, and she was the physio.
And Connor
Schumark. Yeah, you know, and anytime I wanted anything, they were there, like, all my... and they liaised with each other, so I had the best plans put in place. And like Emma, when I went to see her, I was there for an hour and a half, 2 hours every time I went, and I went 5 days a week for probably 6 months. And then it's probably not as regular now because it's more about strengthening and up and all that, so I still go and see her regularly, but it's not as... you know, we've done so much of it now. It's more about strengthening it up now, and then so I'm seeing Connor more. But I was gym and physio all day, every day for 6 months, and I just wanted to have the, you know, well, one of course I wanted to come back in that, but looking to the future, I will need a new knee in a few years. I did need to learn to walk again a couple of times, and if the best chance of me doing that was paying for it, that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I was kind of forced to do, and Dave, you know, all I wanted to do was put my knee replacement off as far as possible, because they're not, don't think they last that long. I don't think they're like hips. And that's why they didn't give me a new one originally. I was too young. So I just wanted, you know, I just want the best quality of life I have, that I can have. And that was the option I had. That's the only option I had, really.
You speak so fondly about an awful lot of aspects of the sport, and there are some I know that frustrate you, and I know you're staying with us, so there'll be plenty of opportunity to vent some of those frustrations if you want to. Can you pinpoint a time in this nearly two-decade career where you were at your happiest?
I think the last few years, yeah, when the good horses were there. Obviously, we had Paisley, well, he was a mainstay since 2019, as you've seen, and then, you know, we picked up Epitone, Jambon, Put the Kettle On One Champion Chase and all that, and there was always a good army of good horses behind, and I get to September and there was a lot to look forward to, and they hit the board, you know. We had big winners regularly all through my career, but obviously from 2019 on, I was, you know, on the big stage a lot, and I kind of gave up the idea of ever wanting to be champion jockey and being that sort of slave to the game. That just wasn't for me, and
was that a turning point? Once you reconciled yourself to that? I know we touched on it earlier.
Yeah, because once you weren't ruled by... Every year before that was numbers. There was 100 winners, and put myself in the best position to be champion jockey one time when it was realistic. And it wasn't really realistic when AP and Dickie were riding, and Brian looked pretty unbeatable for the first couple of years. He was getting it, and I just enjoyed those good horses so much. I kind of wanted to focus on them rather than... the numbers side of it, and since I did that, I think I rode better, and I enjoyed it more. And I'd much prefer to have a few good rides on a Saturday than I probably still rode every other day, to be honest, but it was I enjoyed the good horses.
Luck on Sunday, brought to you by Whirlpool. Bet with the world.